Hi, this is Toby Philpott. I was inside Jabba the Hutt on Return of the Jedi, and I recommend that you tune in and listen to conversations on verbal shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Oh, hey everybody, it's Scott, and welcome to Verbal Shenanigans, episode something or
other. 290?
We would have one more if old Dumb Fingers here didn't accidentally pull a cord out.
I've been trying to get a nickname for you since I've been going by the Pearls for so long. Dumb Fingers and the Pearls seemed like a great like midday show. I feel we should call up some FM Hot 100 stations and get that going.
So sorry for the depressed tone. Me and Mike just did a. Well, first off, you're tuning into Verbal Shenanigans. Hello, everybody. If this is your first experience with us, then I'm Scott. That's Mike. We're a weekly
Usually
show.
We're more joyful and excited.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen. Don't judge us on this intro.
Don't worry. Neither of us has COVID, but right now it feels like I do. I guess I'll just jump right into it. We were interviewing a pretty recognizable actor, especially as far as like his look and his face and his voice and whatnot, has been in like tons of different things, and he was this the type of guest that could go on and tell you amazing stories, and he did story after story after story with big director after big director after big director. And it went on for, now we do a lot of interviews where we bring people on and they're on for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half hour. And we've lost a couple interviews over time. And what happened was, every once in a while we have like a delay problem. And like Mike's thing goes into like this trippy hip hop sound where Mike's just delayed for a while. And old Fat Fingers here went to pull the headphone cord out, but instead pulled out the recorder cord. And when that like drops out instantly, we lose a complete file. So we didn't lose a 20-minute file. We didn't lose an interview with, I don't know, a pogo stick guy from Wisconsin or a roller skating, who knows? I don't know. Mascot or something like that. We lost a hour and a half interview that I don't know if we're going to be able to reschedule. So I'm sorry for the tone of the show. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're contacting the podcast guys. We're saying we're willing to sacrifice, and we gave them a long list of some of the people we talked to. We haven't heard back yet. You know, we threw in some inspirational speakers, some American Gladiators.
like a trade.
We actually went through our list of interviews we had to redo because of some kind of issue. We're like, we'll go back and sacrifice those. There's maybe one.
I could sacrifice about 50 episodes to trade in for that one. 50 interviews.
Yeah. Yeah, Verbal Shenanigans, we're coming towards 300. 250 are pretty good.
This could have been a potential 300 guest, the way this person was talking, some of the stories. It was just like one of those gut reactions where you just, you know, pull something out to make a sound stop with whatever causes that, some kind of internet connection. You just go to pull it out, and then you pull out the other one just in the slightest. And we lost our file, Berlo.
You know, like when you drive for decades and you never get in an accident or get in a ticket, and then just for no good reason, something, your mind just goes askew, and then all of a sudden, wham.
Yeah.
One of those things.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. We could pout about it. We could vent about it. But
okay, I got an hour.
People, I guess, have it much worse right now. So, Berlo, I'm gonna try to move on from this. I'm gonna take my lumps. You could yell at me. You could curse at me. It's okay. I can take it. And we're gonna move forward with this show because we do have a good show for people today. We do. We have a very cool show.
I'm very upset. Your mother wears combat boots, Scott.
Well, she does. She does. My mom was a Marine.
Oh, I didn't plan on that. That was my go-to in high school.
Yeah. Well,
now I'm bummed two times. Now. I hope you're happy.
Would it make you feel any better that my mom was a Marine and served in combat, and the reason she wears boots is to honor her lost friends? Like.
Well, she doesn't have to wear them all the time.
According to her, she does. Like, because, you know, all the people that she served with blew up and died and lost limbs and things like that. And you're just casually, oh, it's okay, yeah, whatever. Your mom wears combat boots. You think that's going to really make me feel better?
Well, Scott, if your mother was aware of what occurred tonight and realized I needed a good, like, gotcha to her son...
Yeah.
She would be like more like trivialized and more shocked by the statement I had. But no, she wears them all the time as a fashion statement and to show that she's a pure American. So
yeah,
I hope she's happy.
Well, and you know, if you go back and look at her wedding photo, it's like the nice, beautiful white dress. And then there's like the combat boots peeking out the bottom.
Yeah. And they were like muddy and the tracks are all through the floor. Like you saw, like the wedding planner was pissed off. He put out the red carpet and ruined.
Yeah,
because of your military mama.
Then you move forward, and she had pictures of like me, like in, you know, in the hospital bed. You look at her; she's in that gown. Her boots are sticking out of the bottom.
Yeah, the stirrups ruined. Right. Like they never, like, you're supposed to take your shoes off, and your mom's like, "No, I'm a proud military mom. I won't do it. This is for my country."
You know, it was kind of awkward. You know, tomorrow is my 1 year anniversary. It makes me think of at my wedding when my mom was, we were dancing together and my mom was wearing those combat boots and she kept putting those steel toes on mine and it kind of hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why everybody who dances with your mom limps, because she's so patriotic.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make me feel any better because I was trying to get a quick one on you. But no, you point out all these truths. Now I'm a little peeved. I'm more peeved than losing the interview, Scott. I gotta be honest with you. Your mother has done it again.
Well, the only way we can make this up to ourselves is to quickly introduce our... I think we should jump right into our guest. We have a very cool guest on the line, on the phone right now. We're going across the pond. We've been very worldly in the last month and a half.
Quite a few Australias, yep. A couple of United Kingdoms.
Yep.
Like tonight. We are the international sensations, and your mom doesn't appreciate us going to other countries, being how patriotic she is. She would fit in really well down by you.
That
size 12 combat boot in my face and says, "See that? Made in America."
So we're gonna rally the troops, guys. No pun intended. We're gonna put ourselves in better moods, and we're gonna get this cast moving the direction it does. Because 2020 has been fantastic, and we're both healthy and okay, and we don't have COVID, and we haven't lost any of our family. So I feel like losing an interview. It's gonna be okay. It's going to parlay itself back into hopefully an even better interview.
Or be super awkward.
We lose the interview and it's just a moment in time, a blip on the radar. Like the time I talked to Sean Kemp, but he never came on the show. Like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you talk to an ex-supersonic and nobody hears it, did it actually occur?
With that, Mike, I think you should explain who we got coming on the cast tonight.
Well, tonight, Scott, we are going to be talking with artist Toby Philpott, who is well known for his puppetry work in various movies. We're going to be talking with him about his various works that includes playing Jabba the Hutt in Return of the Jedi.
Oh.
Aubrey 2 in Little Shop of Horrors. And also doing various puppetry work in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yep. And what was the Jim Henson movie before the big one with all the puppets and whatnot?
Dark Crystal.
Yeah, Dark Crystal. Yeah. So amazing resume. You got to check this guy out. So let's call across the pond and let's get our man Toby Philpott on the line.
Toby?
Hello, yes.
Hey, Toby.
So, Toby, I mean, unfortunately, we all have any interview we've been doing, we got to ask the regular question of how's everybody doing over there in your household during this pandemic?
Well, we're sort of okay. My partner's had a virus of some sort, but of course, without testing, you don't know, is it just flu? Is it, you know, it's a... She's not been well,
right?
But not with the classic symptoms, and I don't seem to have caught anything. And we live in the country, so we're not in the city where you can't even go on the street. You know, we have a field out the back. I can walk the dogs in the woods, and so my lockdown isn't too locked down.
Gotcha.
It's relatively comfortable. When we were living in the city a year ago, it would have been a nightmare because you couldn't take the dogs to the park and you couldn't walk up the street and, yeah. You know. Mm. So we're not too bad. And she's definitely getting better. And I whether or not it was that particular virus, we don't know. Hmm. But overall, we're well.
That's great to hear, and prayers for her to getting better and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, Toby, I researched you going into this interview, and you had a lot of background with different performing arts and everything growing up, but I found it kind of interesting that you have parents that were, your dad was a puppeteer, your mom was a singer and actress, but they didn't really want you, encourage you going into like the performing arts career. Why was that?
Well, my dad was an absentee dad. They separated when I was about six or something. So I don't know what my dad's opinion would have been. But my mum definitely thought I was smart. And, I passed good exams and got scholarships and things. So she wanted me to do university and, you know, get a degree. And it wasn't so much that she didn't want me in the arts, more that she thought I could do better. I could, you know, do something more impressive than that. So she was a bit upset when I dropped out in the 60s, much like most people of my age. Yeah. I was 21 in 1967, do you know what I mean? And I dropped out when I was 18 in 64, so I sort of peaked as a kind of hippie. I was living in Notting Hill Gate in London. So she was very disappointed in me to not go to university and so on. But my dad was quite pleased. I mean, when I dropped out, I did write to him. I didn't see him that often. And he sent me a very encouraging letter because he himself was a bohemian. You know, in the 30s, during the Great Depression and all that, he was already dropped out. He was already a theosophist and a vegetarian. And he made his living doing puppeteering, which was, you know, not terribly lucrative. I don't think he made much money. But he was definitely an early dropout, you know.
Right.
So he wasn't so disappointed when I decided that I didn't want to be an academic. I didn't know I wanted to end up in showbiz. That was an accident. But my mum just thought I could do better. That was the main reason that she was disappointed. The fact that I grew up with the arts in the background, it only grew on me later that the dropping out thing of academia and abstract thinking and all that sort of stuff, I still didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And I wandered about for, you know, a few years. I mean, I went to live in Paris in a squat. And when all the hippies were going to India, me and my French girlfriend decided we were going to go to America. Just being bloody minded, really. We just went west instead of east.
Right.
And we flew into New York and met some people and hitchhiked across. I mean, I wouldn't hitchhike now, right? But in those days, hitchhiking meant that you would be picked up by like-minded people. the youth culture in America in 71, which is when we arrived, was very supportive. And, you know, we were looked after everywhere we went. And we hitched right away across to go and visit a friend of mine in California, an English guy who'd moved there. So I went right the way across America by, you know, on the ground without flying or anything. And I've been in, well over a dozen states, and I lived in America for about 18 months. So I have kind of an affection for America, really. You know, I was a bit scared a lot of the time because I didn't really have any money or skills and things. But it was actually when I got to Austin, Texas, to be honest, when I discovered showbiz, because we were making jewelry and selling it in the streets and stuff. And Austin was, it wasn't typical of the rest of Texas. It was a bit of a, well, it probably still is, isn't it? It's,
yes. I think their motto there right now is "Keep Austin Weird." I believe that is their official motto.
Yeah, it's a unique place, you know. And
absolutely,
we were on the main drag selling jewelry and stuff like that. And by then, I'd learned to juggle just as a pastime, and I was doing it. And some guy said to me, "I'd forget the jewelry if I were you. You know, you should take that up." And I went, "Why? How would I make a living doing juggling?" But anyway, they took me into the university. They were showing some W.C. Field films, including one where he juggles. And they threw me on in front of the movies. And this thing that was just a hobby of mine suddenly was an act, and I had to turn it into a routine, you know, which would not have happened in England. It would not have happened even in America, probably, because I was kind of a shy person.
But then
we went down through Nuevo Laredo into Mexico. My visa was running out for the States. And we went into Mexico, spent 6 months in Mexico. Well, they didn't need handmade jewelry or anything, but they loved juggling and a bit of magic. And I started working in the street, you know, in marketplaces and things, and passing the hat. After 6 months, it had just become my thing, you know. I decided I could do this.
Yeah.
Of course, then I got back to London in sort of November, December, a cold, brutal winter, and street performing wasn't a thing then. I mean, nowadays it's a profession, you know, but back then you couldn't really do it. So I went hungry for a year or two, but I'd become obsessed with, I'm going to be an entertainer. I'm going to be a juggler. I did kids' parties and, you know, weddings and anything I could get my hands on. I did court jester at medieval banquets in restaurants, and it was all a bit grubby to start with, but it meant that I could spend my whole day doing something I loved.
Now, do you find it interesting, like you said, your father was, you know, absent and he was a puppeteer. Do you find it, like how did you, it seems like you almost followed his path in a way as far as some of your interests and whatnot.
Yeah, I think it was unconscious. I mean, because he was a weekend dad, I used to visit him all through my childhood, you know.
Right.
Used to visit him on the Saturday and stuff. And all his friends were not just puppeteers, but musicians and sculptors and painters. My mum's subculture, if you want, was theatre. So although she'd been a performer, she became a teacher just because it was a steadier income for bringing up kids. But it meant that I was backstage of all kinds of art forms. I guess that's the... And unconsciously, I realized that I didn't feel comfortable with the idea of going to university or anything like that. I thought grown-ups did things that they really loved, and if they were lucky, got paid for it. And when it dawned on me that if I wasn't setting out to have a big house and a car, and not necessarily to have kids or anything like that, but to do something I loved, I sort of fell on my feet. So it's one of those things, you know, some people make a plan for what they're going to do with their lives. And I didn't really have a plan, but the universe kept shoving things towards me, you know, going, try this, try that. Hey, look. And the main trick was, I'm going to spend what little time we all have here doing something I love and doing something I hope contributes to the community, i.e. cheers people up. I mean, the one thing I discovered when wandering around Mexico was that if I made people happy, they put me up in their house. They bought me a meal. They looked after me. They gave me a lift to the next town. And money wasn't really the big issue. The big issue was contributing to the community and feeling part of it. And I bless the Mexicans for that, because that's what I learned there. It's not quite a third world country, but do you know what I mean? A very poor country.
Where
what you were trading was your own energy rather than money or things. It was to do with putting a smile on people's face. As simple as that. And that became kind of a vocation. When I eventually started making money doing it as well, that was good. You know? But instead of going to drama school, is what I'm saying, instead of doing 3 years, drama school and trying to get into showbiz that way, I did the hard graft. I did it. But I wasn't alone. In the 70s in England, at least, there was, probably in America, there was a fringe theatre movement. There was a whole movement of not the professional standard showbiz thing, but of people being adventurous and experimental, so that eventually traditional theatre started changing as well, just like the universities started changing. Everything became like experimental. So the 70s was a really interesting time to be trying to do something original and different. Just for instance, I ended up working in New Circus, i.e. Circus Without Animals. And that was that street performing stuff was the very beginnings of that. It was people trying to get away from just doing plays or learning lines and so on, but to actually put on a show where you draw on anything you've got. You know, it doesn't matter if someone can do drumming and someone can do dancing and someone can do juggling, you could kind of put a show together. It was kind of reinventing vaudeville. Do you know what I mean? Which had almost disappeared, that whole kind of variety thing. And we reinvented the live show. I guess that's what I'm saying. Nice. People don't go to the theatre to see plays, but if you just went into the street or into bars or unusual places, community centres and so on, and put show very popular kind of shows on, you learn a lot very quickly. I mean, you learn, you know, because if you're doing a street show and you're not good, the people just walk away. It's quite simple. Well, they don't pay you. And you learn to do very popular stuff and to do it well, you know. And I'll give you an idea. The place where I trained for 2 or 3 years, at least in London, was just a kind of community centre that did theatre workshops. Well, one of the end-of-term shows we put on used everybody. In that show was Piers Brosnan, John Ratzenberger, who's the postman in Cheers.
Right.
There was a bunch of people. Yeah. I mean, so basically, rather like going to drama school, my peer group were a bunch of people who went on to be successful. And they probably look at it and go, oh, and he went on to do Star Wars. So, so did John Ratzenberg, and so did Ray Hassett. And
it's interesting.
I guess what I'm groping towards is that my mum's training, she was a voice coach and taught people like Patrick Stewart how to do Shakespeare. And it's not to do with accents. It's to do with where you place your breathing so that you can speak in a big theatre and keep going for 3 hours. And you know, because her training was in singing and voice. So it was classic technique is what I'm trying to say. And for years, I didn't think she was terribly proud of me doing my street stuff until I bumped into one of her students one day. And she said, oh, you're Sheila Moriarty's son. And I went, yes. And he said, you know, she's really proud of you. And I said, well, she's never said it. And he said, oh, yeah, she's always quoting you. She's going, you've got to do 3 years training. Of course, if you've got real talent like my son, then you don't need to do this training. You just, you know. It would just once. It would have been nice if she said it to me.
Yeah, well.
So let's kind of dive into from what I've read up. I mean, how you got in touch with like Jim Henson and Frank Oz was it was just basically like a workshop to determine who's working on these films. Was it as simple as that?
Well, there's a short version and a long version of all these stories. My dad died in 78, and I was a bit broken up, and I found it very difficult to do my solo street show, clowning and stuff. I was a bit, you know, my emotions were all over the place. So I decided to go and study mime. I thought I'll take a few months off, and I'll study a new skill, something for the poet in me, something to be sad with, you know, whatever. And my mime teacher had done movement coaching for films. So, for instance, he did the apes in Greystoke. He coached the actors. So while I was doing this mime course, he was in touch with movies. And it was him that rang me and said, hey, there's an advert for people to do big creatures for The Dark Crystal. And I said, oh, you know, I'm just a street performer. He went, no. They don't really know what they need. It says acrobats, mimes, dancers, clowns. You know, because there was no training, there were no previous experienced people to go for this. So there was no audition where you could go in and go, what I'm going to do is this, because obviously you couldn't present it, you haven't got a costume and so on. So the way Jim and Frank did it was they put us in a, I mean, hundreds of people applied, but they put us in a room at 20 at a time with a few you know, a funny glove and a funny head and stuff like that, and just workshopped us in puppets, going, okay, here's a head. Can you be a sleeping creature that wakes up, looks around, and then walks off? And what ended up as a mystic, for instance, is something that I was doing improvising in a workshop in front of them. And I think they were looking for people who were physically fit, understood puppetry and the expressiveness, which, of course, I'd got from my dad.
Right.
And also teamwork, because we're going to work really closely with each other. You know, some of these puppets involve three or four people working together. So it's to do with your temperament as well as your skill. You can always learn another skill, you know, but you need to be starting off from being willing to adapt and adjust. And because of my weird experiences of the previous 10 years, I was very different from a dancer who goes, show me the dance moves and I'll do them, but it couldn't make things up. I'd been making things up for a decade, you know, so I just kind of, I knew the minute I walked in there, I knew it was probably my job. I mean, I am perfect for this.
Yeah.
And it gave me the confidence to, I think being in America had done that too, because, you know, English people are very, false modest, do you know what I mean? Very shy, and right. I'm not good at this. And having been in America for a long time, I'd opened up to the, hey, I can do this. I could do this. You know, you need me for this. And that kind of confidence got me through from the 200, it went down to 50, and then it went down to 20. And then it went down to, we're going to pick 10 people. And I was in the 10. And then they said four people will carry on working now in pre-production while the costumes are being finished and so on. And the other six will come back next spring and work on the movie. Mm-hmm. And I got into the four. I mean, I was just going, this is perfect. I've been on perfect for this. This is, and then I had a back injury. It's like, I won't go into the details, but it was like very frustrating.
Yeah.
Simon Williamson took over from me in the four, and I had to spend the winter recovering. And then in the spring, I came back as part of this team of 10 people. And we thought we were just doing the big creatures because they were so uncomfortable. The puppet people didn't want to do the big creatures.
Right.
You know, the Gotham and the Mystics and so on. But of course, the nature of the Dark Crystal was so different from any film that even the Muppets had done before. Because the Muppets are mostly one or two people puppets. Dark Crystal was so original that, as well as the big creatures, we all got assigned to be support puppeteers with one of the Muppet people. Hmm. And I got picked to be on Jim's team. I never found out quite how. But me and Robbie Barnett were his sidekicks, so that he would be doing the main performance, but we would be doing the other hand or making the eyes move or whatever. So I learned puppetry from the Grandmaster.
Wow.
You know.
What was Jim like to work with? What kind of guy was he, especially with you guys being, you know, relatively new and relatively his trainers? What was he like?
Complete novices, you know. Like. First of all, he was a complete sweetheart. I mean, he was the gentlest, nicest person, one of the nicest people I've ever met. He was always soft-spoken. He never told you that you'd done something wrong. He would just say, "That's not quite what I would imagined. Try this," or that didn't really work. How about if we? And he was always asking you to contribute rather than ordering you about. And he was like that with everybody, not just with me and Robbie, but with the. That was his approach. Was if anyone's got a better idea of how to do this, offer it up. Now, lots of bosses might say that, but most bosses don't mean it. Whereas Jim specifically meant it. He surrounded himself with talent and wanted them to excel.
That's awesome.
That's really rare in a boss, you know. So, I mean, the reason I know this is not just my impression of him, although it is my impression of him. One day, because I was his other half, one day we were lying on a trolley. We were going to be wheeled along doing a walking move for a puppet.
Right.
But you're lying there waiting for the lighting to be done and the thing and the thing. Now, mostly I didn't speak to him because he's directing a movie, performing in a movie and running a company. And I would just be very, very modest and sit there and wait, you know. Mm-hmm. But when you're there long enough and it's a 10-hour day, eventually you start talking. And I did say to him one day, do all these things at once and still stay calm and on top of it all? And he went, I hire the most talented people I can find and I trust them to do their job without me looking over their shoulder the whole time.
Nice. Yeah.
And I went, wow. And I mean, there was a day when we were doing this, when this guy came up, man in the suit came up and said, we've got some problem with the office in LA or something. And Jim said, okay, have you got your toothbrush and your passport? And the guy said, yes. And he went, go and sort it out. And the guy went, and I went, wow, this guy's running an empire. But that's how he did it. And I said, so, how do you make that decision so quickly? And he went, it costs money to not decide. He said, you know, it's costing you £90 a second or £500 a minute or whatever it's just to be here on the film set, you know. Even though there's lots of hanging around, he said, I make the decision quickly and I trust people to try and make it work. And if it doesn't work, to come back to me and tell me that I've got to make another decision. Again, most bosses would go, I don't want someone coming back telling me I made the wrong decision. And he just went, it's just I hire the best people I can get and I trust them to do their job. And that takes all the strain off, you know. So he was a sweetheart, and I learned so much from him because just hanging around him, you imagine, I'm standing next to him while he's talking to the assistant director and the lighting man and the sound guy. He and Frank are talking and discussing how they're going to manage this, doing something that neither of them had ever done before either.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Yoda was about the only sophisticated animatronic puppet that had been made. It wasn't actually made by Jim's Creature Shop, but it was a very small group of people. George Lucas and Jim were, you know, working quite closely together.
Yeah.
And Frank operated, awesome. Obviously. So, you know, it was a very small world. And to me, it's almost as though Dark Crystal was a showcase of what else you could do, because they already knew Yoda was fantastic. So, in a funny way, it was almost a showcase of, like, wow. You know, offering George some more.
Yeah.
You want some creatures for the future? And, you know, 6 months later, I'm working on Jabba the Hutt in Return of the Jedi, which was built by the same people that were working on Dark Crystal. Not entirely, but, you know, by a team that had... Because it was the next film into the same studio.
Right.
And it just rolled over. I mean, I got the job without auditioning. I didn't even know how I'd got the job to start with.
Toby, looking at you, I would cast you as a Jedi right now. I think you would be you would be the perfect Jedi Master, man.
Yeah, it's come out that way now. But, we're talking 40 years ago, right?
You went from apprentice to master.
What actually happened, they didn't tell me this, but I mean, I just got called in and they said, you've been doing Big Creatures, would you like to do this? And they showed me a kind of sketch of Jabba and I went, sure. And they said, you know, it's a two-person puppet, so, you know, is there someone you'd like to work with? Long story short, I suggested a couple of people, but eventually they went, how would you feel about working with David Barclay? And I went, fine. You know, he was a friend of mine. His parents were also puppeteers, like my dad. And I didn't realize at the time that Dave had got the job already and he had picked me to be his sidekick.
Oh, that's so cool.
Oh, wow.
There was this weird politics going on that, you know, they're trying to get me to choose him. Well, I would have been stumbling around for ages. But it took me a long time to find out. It was only when I went to a convention in round about 2002 or something that Dave said, no, I got you the job. I thought I picked you. But, I mean, David is a serious puppeteer. Not only did he work on building puppets and operating them and special makeup and things, but he still does. I mean, he's right now in the film business. He lives in LA. I mean, he's a much more serious puppet realm person than me. I'm just this kind of generalist that says yes to anything, you know. Could you do this? Could you do that? And I, I'll give it a go. But I'm not a specialist. David is he's a genius. He's, you know, he's just, that's what he does. But he got me the job, and he got me the job on Who Framed Roger Rabbit too. He was asked to build a little puppet team to do the things the special effects guys couldn't manage, i.e. improvise solutions on the set. You know, if the director had a great idea, the effects people hadn't spent time working out how to do it. So we were the improv group that jumped in and found solutions. And again, David got me that work. So, you know, I owe these jobs to him, really. At least part.
That's incredible. So are you able, do you guys have like a monitor in that costume while you're doing this? How are you able to kind of get an idea of how the puppet's moving in there? And on a side note, my wife wanted to make extra sure I told you, her favorite scene is watching Job again choked out with the tongue flying everywhere.
Of course. Well, the technology in 81, which is when we were doing Dark Crystal, and 82 when we were doing Jedi, the technical level was quite low. First of all, the Muppets, because they specialized in puppets, they tried to arrange that you could see a screen. If you could see a monitor somewhere, then you would actually see the frame that the camera was seeing. So you would know if you were in close up, you'd know if you're in the left side of the frame or on the edge of the frame, whatever. You could position yourself. And that came from their TV work. So they literally had a TV camera, a video camera attached to the main camera. And they fed it through so that you were seeing a true image of what it was you were doing. Now, obviously, if you're doing a puppet in a hole in the ground, you can have a monitor near you and you can turn your head, which is how they do the Muppets.
Right. But
when we were inside the Mystics and the Gartham, there wasn't room for a monitor. So we rehearsed the moves with the heads off and then did it blind, basically. Now, with Jabba, because it wasn't a specialist puppet set, they understood we needed to see what we were doing, but they didn't understand that ideally we would see through the lens, actually see the frame that we were working in. And what they had was a kind of a black and white security camera up in the roof somewhere that just showed Jabba. So it didn't show the interaction with the other characters. And Dave and I each had a, I don't know what you call it, really. It was a monitor, but it was about 4-inch square, black and white, grainy image,
right,
on a box about a foot long, hanging off our necks. You know, so we could roughly see Jabba, but we couldn't see where we were in the frame. So, if I'm doing hand gestures, for instance, it's nice to know if you're on the edge of frame to be decisively in the frame or get out of it, not to wobble in and out from the edge. But that was the best they could offer us because they're shooting on a set with, 60 characters on there and probably about 150 people because some of the characters are two or three people. And then you've got the makeup people and the lighting people and the, you know, everyone, the nurse, the fireman, the carpenters.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of people, and they're not very interested that two or three puppeteers go, we can't quite see what we're doing.
Yeah.
It wasn't very important. So the way we did it was we had the guy that was radio controlling the eyes of Jabba was outside, and he could talk to the director about what was needed. And then he would relay it to us through the headphones. And we would try it out, and he would tell us what did or didn't work. And so as a team, we were, what we said to the director, what we said to Richard Marquand, please don't say who's doing the left hand. Can you move the left? Talk to us like an actor. You know, we got this from the Muppet people, of course. Talk to the puppet like it's a real living being. You know, if Sean Connery was on the Muppets, he didn't look down at Jim and go, what am I supposed to be doing? He'd say to Kermit, what am I supposed to be doing?
So that
brings the puppet to life. If the actor and director and everyone treats it as a living being, then it's our problem to manifest that. You know, we said, just pretend it's Marlon Brando and go, I want you to be angry and then look to the left and shout at him and grab him and punch that and, you know, eat the frog, whatever you do. And then while they were doing the other stuff, me and Dave, Mike Edmonds, who's the little guy in the back doing the tail, and the radio control guys, who were some of the builders. So there's four or five of us, and we're all talking on headsets about what does and doesn't work and how we're going to do it, and just practicing until they went, okay, we're going for it. Because we were the main character on the set, you know. I mean, I'd been used to being a background character where it didn't really matter if I got it right. Well, we were the main, you know, suddenly everyone else is background characters and we're the ones in close-up. You know?
Right. At any point, and now you're coming off of working with Henson, you're now working with George Lucas, you know.
Yeah.
At this point, this film, you know, is massive because Star Wars exploded. At any point, I mean, you're kind of seasoned at that point, but at any point, are you guys intimidated to work on this film? To like, is there a time frame? What is it? Give us like a insight into like the shooting kind of schedule of a puppeteer and how much leeway you guys get, you know, to really get the shot right. And you know, you, like you said, you got 60 something people standing around kind of relying on you.
Where, although it was big, because it was the third of the trilogy,
yes,
I hadn't actually seen the first two Star Wars. For various reasons. I was full-time working in evenings, so I didn't go to cinemas and things. I didn't have a TV. I didn't have any kids to take to the movies. And somehow I'd missed, I'd heard about it. Of course, I knew Star Wars. But when I got hired to do Jabba, they just brought me in and said it's a film called Blue Harvest, and there was no hint that it was a Star Wars movie.
Oh, nice!
That was the first thing, was that we didn't know straight away that's what it was. Secondly, as soon as I realised, because it was called Revenge of the Jedi on the call sheets, I went, "Oh!" So I had to go out. There were no DVDs. There were no. There was no streaming. No VHS. Nothing. I had to go and find a cinema showing the first two Star Wars movies back to back. And I went into a cinema, and 4 hours later, you know, I came out going, oh, whoa, now I'm overawed. Now I'm scared, you know. now I know what I'm going to be taking part in. And it was like, wow. So, yeah, for a bit then, I was a bit kind of, whoa.
Yeah.
But then on the day, when you get to do it, first of all, I just spent 6 months doing Dark Crystal. So I'd got used to puppets and I'd got used to the film process.
Right.
And it's a bit bizarre filming because, how do you say it? You're doing a 10-hour day. You sometimes do a six-day week sometimes, 5 or 6 days a week, 10 hours. And you're getting maybe 3 minutes of film in a day.
Right.
So a lot of filming is hanging around, waiting for everyone else to get ready.
Yep.
And then suddenly you do something which, if you get it right, will be in the film forever. And the best metaphor I could think of was you're a 100-meter runner for the Olympics. You spend 4 years training. You get to the Olympics. Yeah. You're at the front line, and you've now got 10 seconds to be the best sprinter in the world, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when they say action, and you're doing 10 seconds, if you get it right, it's in the film. If you don't, people sigh, take two, take three. And you've always got this trade-off between shots that are really important that you want to get right and ones that don't really matter. And if it's not perfect, doesn't matter, move on, you know, because there's money involved.
Mm-hmm.
We got that. Jim spent a lot of money on Dark Crystal because he wanted to get things right. And he would do lots of takes. Now, Star Wars, big budget. Lots of people on the set. As I say, I've got a call sheet somewhere and it says coffee and biscuits for 150 people. So on the busiest days on that set, you didn't want to be wasting people's time. You try and get it right in one. Of course, if you can do it right in one, that's perfect. Quite often you do it right and then the sound wasn't right or the lighting wasn't right or, you know, the other actor wasn't right. So you have to do it again. And you keep trying to do your bit right. But there's always a chance they'll pick one of the takes which wasn't your best one, but it's good enough. It's got all the other bits working. You know, they can fix it in the edit. They can change the sound or whatever. So you're always doing your best, but you never know if they're going to capture your best. And there are moments when they don't want to do it lots of times. I'll give you a good example. When I hit Anthony Daniels in the C-3PO costume, because I'm the left hand, right? So... I had to say to them, you know, I can't really see what I'm doing. And so I went outside, I climbed out of Jabba, and Anthony Daniels said, well, I can't see what I'm doing because he's in the C-3PO mode. So the fighter ranger is going, right, so neither of you can see what you're doing. Okay. And you've got to hit him in the chest. Okay, so we'll shoot it from a low angle so that you can miss him by 2 or 3 inches. And he checked with me that I could do a stage fighting move, if you want, like a sudden blow that stops.
Right.
Accurate. And then they took Anthony Daniels' leggings off, because if he fell over in that suit, he'd not only damage the suit, but damage himself. And they shot from a low angle, so you only see the top half of him. And then I climbed back inside Jabba, and I, you know, they line it up, and I do it in slow motion, and we block it all out, and then they go, ready, and action, and I go, thump, and he goes, ouch, and falls backwards. I think we did it twice, but, you know, yeah. The thing was, they couldn't fit a stuntman into that costume. So I had to do that with the real actor, and if I'd actually hurt him, you know, I could delay production and cost money and all that. So you do that kind of shot once or twice, you know, and you go, that's enough.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks terrific, you know. I mean, it looks great. It still frightens me when I watch the film. I still jump. At the time, I had no idea what we'd, you know, whether we'd achieved it. But they went, "Yeah, fine, great, move on." And sometimes you do a shot like that, and it doesn't even end up in the movie. You can end up on the cutting room floor. So you keep trying to do your best. But there's also a lot of hanging around, you know, just hanging around waiting and getting nervous. So what I'd learned from The Dark Crystal was to keep the energy level up, but not to spend your whole day jittery, you know, nervous, because that thwarts your performance. You've got to stay relaxed. Jim and Frank were fantastic at keeping people relaxed but energetic by creating a wonderful atmosphere of fun. And I mean, when I worked with Frank on Little Shop of Horrors, for instance, he brought a table tennis table in for the puppeteers.
Nice.
So when we were hanging around for an hour or two while they were fixing the set and doing all that stuff, we would have table tennis tournaments just to keep people, you know, keep people snappy and interested and up.
It'd be great if you guys played each other, like left arm versus the right arm.
I played Frank. I couldn't beat him. He was very good. But I did play doubles on his side, and we won. Because I don't know if the team were letting the director win.
I stopped while you were gone. We couldn't do it without you. Go ahead, Mike.
What I was getting to was, you kind of brought up an interesting thing, how you do all this work and art and stuff gets cut on the floor. Like, I've read up on, you had the big scene in Little Shop of Horrors with the work, and they killed the ending because it didn't test well. When you're a street performer and you get that kind of instant gratification, does that kind of take away some of your, like, artistic love when you're seeing these kind of things with business decisions and movie decisions?
No, I think it was a very different realm to go into. You've got to understand, when my dad was a puppeteer, he was one of those guys that had a booth, and he would come out and talk to the audience. But when he went inside, he's a one man doing all the puppets, all the voices. I mean, he built the booth, he made all the puppets, so literally a one man show. And he loved live performance because the puppets can talk to the kids, and the kids talk to the puppets. So you don't stick to a script. Do you know what I mean? If the puppets are saying something and some little kid shouts out, "Look out, he's behind you," or something, then the puppets go, "What? What?" And he loved live performance. He really didn't like doing TV. In fact, he was on TV in 1932, which is before real television got invented. But he may have been one of the first puppeteers on television. This was when only about, you know, probably a couple of hundred people had receivers, and the screen was about 4 inches square. But they used puppets because the image was so raw that they couldn't really do human beings. And a puppet face just painted in brutal black and white was what was needed. So he did TV before TV was really invented. You know, he was working with John Logie Baird.
Yeah.
And so that must have put him off TV, because he went, well, not having feedback from an audience is really difficult. It's a different discipline. And I love street performing. I really can't be an actor. To say other people's words, or to take direction from other people about how to move about or what to do, I find very difficult. I had a go at it. You know, I did a couple of shows, but I'm a natural improviser, and I prefer working on my own. So that when I worked in I worked a double act, and I worked in a show with four or five people, I never felt quite so comfortable as when I just did a solo show on the street, because then it's just me and the audience, and it's completely, the feedback is instant. So, you know, you're either getting it right or you're not getting it right.
Right.
And you can't lie. That's what I'm groping for. You have to tell the truth. You have to be honest. If you're a juggler and you drop something, you can't really cover it. You can have a gag or something, or you can shrug and go, "I'm only human," you know, or the gravity's strong today, or whatever it is. But essentially, you're working on genuine warmth from the people, and if they love you, you do better than you think you can.
I totally relate. Like, as you're talking, like, you know, I do stand-up comedy. Like, I feel very similar. Like, you're alone up there. You're naked up there, in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, there's no band behind you. There's no bass player behind you or drummer behind you. It's just you.
No, there's no one to blame.
Yep.
But the thing was, as I say, because when my dad died, it was like, it hit me harder than I thought it would, because, you know, you don't know these things till they happen to you. And a friend of mine had a group, and he kept trying to get me to come out and perform, and I couldn't do it. So it was perfect for me to suddenly find myself as part of an ant heap or a beehive, where you just had to do the job that you promised to do. Mm-hmm. You're not responsible for it, and there is no immediate feedback from the audience. So filming with Jim was perfect, because you do get another chance to do it. If it didn't work properly, and if they can't get it to work properly and they haven't got time to fix it, well, they just cut it out and they do something else. All they asked of you was that you be a busy little bee and do what you're booked to do, and you don't do anything else, and you literally don't do anything else. Filming is extraordinary. It's so different from a solo show. I mean, just to give you an example, we had little tiny boxes to sit on when we were doing the Mystics, because we were crouched down and all the blood would go out of your legs. And there was a guy whose job it was to bring in my little seat and put it under me, you know, and that was his job. And one day I tried to pick it up and put it to one side. They went, "Oh!" It's almost like a union thing, you know. If you do that, then he hasn't got a job. And, you know, you just do...
Gotcha, yeah.
Just do your job. You don't touch anyone else's hair. You don't move props because they may be set there for a reason. And you walk around going, you just have to concentrate on your bit. And in one way, that's wonderful. It takes... And hiding, of course, because the other thing was with street performing, your face is there. If you're in a good mood or a bad mood, it's all visible to people. If you haven't had time to wash your costume, it's visible to people. Well, being a puppeteer is the exact opposite of that. You know, I grew a beard on Dark Crystal because no one ever saw me. So when I was street performing, I was clean shaven just because it's more expressive and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But to be a puppeteer was the perfect invisible job for someone who was in mourning and didn't want to be seen, you know, because I wasn't there.
Interesting.
You see what I mean? The puppet's there, but I'm not there. So,
yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, we had Howard Berger on the podcast, and Howard kind of a legendary special effects guy. Works with Greg Nicotero. He's done Chronicles of Narnia and all these amazing things. And it was such a fun interview. And some of the things you're saying remind me so much of some of the things he's saying. And I was curious because, you know, you're a practical effects kind of guy, if you will, puppetry, you know, moving things. And then, of course, we got into the stages where, you know, they CGI'd everything to death. And then it seems like now we're kind of moving into a blend of the two where, you know, there's some practical effects that can't be replaced. But, you know, you could use the green screens and the CGI to make them bigger and better. Where did you find yourself part of like the old guard trying to hold on to those things, or were you able to adapt and stay kind of in the business with that?
Well, no, because I'd been hired very specifically.
Right.
Like say you're a specialist for films. I was hired, you know, because I was physically fit. I was an acrobat and a mime.
Gotcha.
By 1986, for instance, I was 40, so they were going to be hiring younger people than me. just on the physical basis. If you think of sports, you know, 40 is already quite old. So I loved the fact that the film... I only worked on half a dozen films, but the ones I worked on were... First of all, they were experimental. No one had done anything like them.
Right.
It was a phase where CGI simply wasn't good enough to do that, because I think George would have liked to have done Jabba with CGI in the first place.
Yep.
He couldn't. And even on Labyrinth, when we did the fires and things, it was very primitive. We didn't really have green screen or anything. With the fires, for instance, they filmed the set, and then they covered the set in black velvet, and they covered us in puppeteers in black velvet. And we did all the moves on top, and then they put the two bits of film together. So... that's why it doesn't look quite terrific. But Jim was busy experimenting. He was going, well, could we do this? Could we do that? And, of course, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, for instance, no one's ever done anything like that since. Spielberg was producing, I think, on that. But he specifically, what they were trying to do was do animation which was done the classic Disney way, i.e., hand painted frame by frame on the celluloid.
Yeah,
I mean literally.
It's amazing. You
know, not done in a computer at all. Thousands and thousands of drawings.
Crazy.
And then using the CGI techniques to add layers on it so that they could add shadows and things. So that was already a combination of classic techniques and modern techniques. And I confess that in 86 or 87, whenever we did that, I pretty well knew my career in films was over because CGI was coming in and because there was a change in the tax regime under Mrs. Thatcher or something, whatever. The film business kind of moved away from England. And, of course, they take their techies with them and they take their stars. But they hire local talent. Suddenly they were filming in New Zealand and Spain and Israel and places because the film business just goes wherever it's cheapest and, you know, most effective for big money. So I could have tried to carry on being a puppeteer in TV here. There were various TV shows. But I wasn't really a puppeteer in that sense. I wasn't, you know, I didn't do lip sync and all that thing. I very specifically had been hired to do big creatures.
Yes.
And a lot of my puppet friends did carry on doing it, and some of them went off to work with the Muppets, and some did TV here and things. But I went back to circus because I'd started in circus as a juggler and acrobat, and I kind of I'd gone into teaching, and I knew that we needed a big training space because although jugglers don't need anything, to get into trapeze and stuff like that, we needed a big space, and we squatted legally, but we squatted a big old building in London, and I spent a year or two whitewashing that and developing it and putting classes together and things. Nowadays, it's a national center for the circus arts, and you can get a qualification in circus. But, you know, in 87, that was just literally an underground movement. We knew it was needed, but we didn't know how to get funding. So we went, let's just do it first to prove that, you know, that the world needs this. And in that process of getting away from films and back into circus, some of my students said, oh, but before you were doing that film stuff, you made a living doing circusy things, juggling and stuff. I went, oh, yeah, yeah. You know, it's a bit of an insecure living, but it's fun. And some of them began doing street shows, and they were winning awards at the Edinburgh Festival and things like this, because street performing was starting to become a proper art form, and there were competitions, you could win prizes and things. And they decided to set up their own little circus. So they scratched some money together and bought a little big top and a generator and some caravans and things. And they came and found me, because I was teaching in a circus school in a city in England. They came and found me and said, do you want to run away with the circus? And I went, yeah. I didn't go over the hill for teaching, but the thought of actually just living on the road in a caravan, tent up and going from town to town, sounded fabulous. So, you know, as you can see, I completely forgot about puppets. I mean, I went back to...
Right.
But rather than street performing, now we're traveling with our own theatre, if you want. You arrive in a town, you go to the park, you put up your tent, all your lighting. We had smoke machines, strobe lights, you know, bubble machines, ropes. I mean, you'd put the whole thing up and all the seating and everything. And that would be your completely familiar theatre. Whereas outside, you didn't even know where the shops were. You didn't know which town. You know, every week you'd have to go and find a new place. But inside, it was our own personal private space. And we could design the performance to fit everything that, you know, that worked in there. And it was just fun. I mean, I did that till about 97 or something like that. A few years, anyway, of just going out in the summer and touring with the circus. In there, funnily enough, we did Treasure Island. We did a pirate show, and they said they needed a parrot for the, you know, to sit on Long John Silver's shoulder, and I made up a little puppet of a parrot for the rehearsals, and he was so good they went, no, we won't get another one made. He's going to be in the show. So I have actually made and performed a puppet in my life.
That's amazing. Toby, we could probably talk to you for another couple hours if we had the time. Unfortunately, we got another interview coming up.
All right.
We can't thank you enough for your time. If people wanted to get in touch with you and hear your stories and your life afterwards, where can they contact you?
Well, there is a website up that's just tobyphilpott.uk. It's best to just put Toby Jabber in Google and you'll find...
Yeah.
I'm on the IMDb and in Wikipedia and things like that, so I'm not hard to find, because no one can ever spell Philpott, so Toby and Jabber's better. I was writing an autobiography, but I haven't finished it. But in terms of stories, you know, I normally go to conventions. Well, at the moment, there aren't any conventions.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much nothing going on besides this podcast right now.
But I'm on email and I'm on Skype, you know, and if people want to talk, you know, or contact me. The email I tend to use for showbiz, again, it's on the website, but it's just jabberhut@gmail.com. And feel free to write to me. You know, I'm always here.
Toby.
And I do sign photos online, but, you know, again, the mails are a bit weird at the moment, so.
Yeah,
we'll be back to normal soon, I sure hope. But, Toby, thank you so much for giving some time, man. I could pick your brain, and maybe we'll schedule a second interview because there's still more stuff I'd love to talk to you about. So thank you for giving us your time, and stay safe, and good luck with everything you're doing, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Make sure I pressed record, Mike. I made sure I pressed record as we're coming out of here. So we're capturing the data. Toby Philpott, everybody, guys. Really, really fascinating stuff. It's again, I really think this podcast is almost having a reverse effect on me over the years. Like, first I wanted to interview amazing people, interesting people. And now I'm just like, what the hell am I doing with my life?
What do you mean?
Like,
you now all of a sudden you're comparing yourselves to our guests and you're realizing, damn, I want to be the person being interviewed.
Yeah, like I want to be the guy, not the one being interviewed. Like I want to be the guy who's puppeteering Jabba the Hutt. Like I want to be the guy out on the streets doing street shows and puppeteering and working with Jim Henson. Meanwhile, all I'm doing is pulling cables, malfunctioning our podcast, and getting to talk to you every week, twice a week.
I mean, 1 out of 5 ain't bad, Scotty. I mean,
which one, Burlo? Which one?
The pulling wires, not talking to me. I've had conversations with myself. It has never gone well. So,
quick update before we kind of get out of here. I just wanted to give everyone an update. If you tuned in, I think it was last episode, I told you about my friend Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve, quote unquote, in our Zoom calls, Burlu.
Drunken so, Zoom Steve.
All right, so here's what happened. Recap, real quick. Flashback. I had a friend, Steve, who I talked to my old high school friends and other friends and whatnot on Friday during this quarantine, and every week he's gotten blackout drunk and passed out during the Zoom call. Burlu, this Friday we had our call. Do you think Steve made it through this call or not? Do you think he shaped up, got through the call, and, you know, just kind of, you know, turned a leaf?
Not only am I going to say no, Scott, I am going to predict you're going to tell us he broke a record in speed of passing out.
Well, okay. So both those answers are... Steve did not make it through the Zoom call. Okay. However, this time, the call was going about 1:15. I was tired. I had something to do in the morning. I said, "Hey guys, I gotta leave." no problem. Now, Steve at that point was 9 beers deep. Okay. I know this because he sent us a picture of his beer pile, you know. Now,
is Steve known for being able to get past a six pack out of curiosity?
Yes, Steve can put him down, but I don't know. Steve has like a shutoff switch, like a sniper comes out of nowhere and just puts Steve down. So, next morning, I text Steve, "Hey, did you make it all the way through the Zoom call?" You know, like busting him a little bit. I was like, "Yeah, I did." 2 minutes later, he's like, "Yeah, I think I did." I'm like, "Oh boy!" So I texted my other friend. I'm like, "Hey, did Steve make it through the Zoom call?" And it took a while for him to get back. He's like, "Well, almost." So apparently, the Zoom call ended around 2, and our friend Steve made it to about 1:45 and pulled the old collapse mode. So,
I guess we gotta give him props. He went like. Like, if this was, like, how long do Zoom calls usually last? Like, length and, like, time frame we talking?
We'll hang out, because we'll start, like, at least these couple weeks, we'll start, like, 9:30 when, like, I don't know, my wife kind of goes to bed a little earlier than I do. So I'll just hang here and where I am right now, and so maybe 2 hours, 2.5 hours sometimes.
Okay, so usually around 11, so we had an extended period and later than usual.
I guess so, but we did start later. We started more closer to 10 this time. So, yeah, but still, I guess you're right.
That's so, still in the that's a good amount of time. 3-4 hour range.
Wow, yeah, I didn't even realize that. So, but yeah, Steve could not pull to the finish line. Just an update. So I will keep you guys updated two episodes from now and see if Steve can finally do it. Berla, do you think Steve makes it in the next one? Now that he's made some progress. Will,
and I feel we need to make like one of them Super Bowl box pools where like on the left-hand side is the beer total and on the top end is the minutes.
Right. And just, okay.
Like everybody puts in $5. 100 boxes. Somebody comes out with $500 when Stevie Sniper Zoom drinker goes Betty by.
It'd be funny. Like you have like the early minutes. You're like, hey Steve, come on, have another beer, bro. Have another beer. Come on, quicker. You know you can't drink this with me.
Yo, Stevie, you know, remember those good old times where we could chug a bottle of whiskey?
Yeah.
I'm sure you got some good stuff over there. What you got?
So.
No, I think Uber Eats can send you over a bottle. Hold up. Let me help you.
Well, that's my update on Steve, guys. So you're going to have to wait two more episodes to hear if he makes it because it's, you know, we gotta get to the weekend here. So, All right. But that might be me on Friday because I'm still thinking about this interview that we lost, so that might be me pounding it in the Zoom. Zoom conference.
Scott, I don't want you to keep being depressed over the lost interview. Maybe we should get depressed about the quarantine.
Oh, great! Let's just pile the depression on. That's usually what helps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, have we been going on this for about 2 months now? Has it been? It's been about two
months. We're getting close.
Conclusion.
Yep.
And you know, I figure. Some people, it's kind of like some people who go to jail and come out realize they can't live a regular life, so they want to get back in jail.
Right.
So maybe we should start looking at jobs that are secluded so our minds can stay at ease.
All right. So like what's that guy that works at the International Space Station, like that kind of that job?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Something where we're by ourselves for a while. Like, I got some examples here. You want to go over some of these things, see if you want to send out a resume?
I would. What would you have to get paid to do the International Space Station for a year? Oh, year away from everyone, you're going out to outer space. What would the salary marker be for you?
I got to think $250,000 just because it's not only you're secluded, you're in space. So there's literally like, at least this seclusion, I can walk out to my porch.
Yeah.
I don't think the space station has a porch that you can like get on the rocker and just chill.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, $250,000. Yeah, I might even go higher than that. That's a long time, man. A year away from everyone. I might go $500,000. Possible.
I would say somewhere in that ballpark. I mean, it's got to be decent money, and it's got to be tax-free. Like, if I say $250,000, I mean, I'm pocketing $250,000.
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
none of that after taxes and my health insurance and all that crap. I mean, no.
So you basically need 1 year of salary of the podcast, like what you make now. So 1 year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my agent's going to call to renegotiate, but
right.
Yeah, I would say 1 year this would equate to 1 year on the space station.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's see here some other jobs here.
Here's the possibility, Scott. Yellowstone National Park Winter Keeper.
I'm in.
Yeah. So for over 40 years, Stephen Fuller's had this position at the Yellowstone Canyon Village as the Winter Keeper. He lives at the park year-round, but his job only starts getting crazy around winter because once the snow starts falling, he gets completely cut off from the rest of the world.
I like
around
it.
November, blizzards that hit the park close off all the roads that allow him to contact his nearest neighbors that are some 16 miles away.
Ah. I kind of like this, though, because I always had like a fantasy of being a park ranger.
Well, I mean, Fuller's been doing the job since 1973. He used to do it with his wife and children, but his wife separated him and left with the children.
Right, right.
One of Fuller's duties has been shoveling hundreds of pounds of snow off various building roofs, a job that he described as a chance to empty your mind, maybe tussle with a question or a problem.
Okay. See, I'm thinking about drive, like snowmobiling around and looking at bears and stuff would be cool, but I don't know about shoveling snow off roofs.
Yeah, that 6 months of shoveling snow, I think you might have a back kind of like mine right about now.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea of like 6 months with my, you know, with people, 6 months with no people, but I don't think it's going to work for me. I got a baby on the way, Berlo.
Gotcha. You need something better. Well, I mean, you say you'd like to work with the earth. How about a fertilizer harvester in Utah?
Okay.
On the lonely Great Salt Lake's west shore in Utah, Todd Simpson works the job harvesting a product most of you have no idea exists, although it's vital of importance to the world. Sulfate of potash. Sulfate of potash is used to create one of the key ingredients in most fertilizers. It also added an advantage of being free from chlorine, which is found in most of the other potassiums. Simpson shares the job with one other person, and they alternate operations facilitating the year for throughout the year. Keeping in mind that it's just one person working the job at a time, their workloads are crazy. They have to keep pump spreads across thousands of acres of shallow evaporation ponds in good working order. The job requires a lot of devotion. The evaporation process in the ponds takes 3 years to come to fruition.
Yeah.
The living facilities consist of a single mobile home hours away from civilization. And Stimson says he can go days without another human person contacting him. His only company is a cat who lives in the home and a satellite television.
See, I'm not too into it. It seems like it's one of those jobs that takes a long time for a little bit of payoff. And the fact that I don't understand why there's only two people doing it. I don't get why they can't increase that workforce and maybe increase the time that it takes. I don't know.
It's Utah. I mean,
yeah.
It's how many other Utahs? I mean, that's probably the most exciting thing in Utah. That's probably what the Utah Jazz did every offseason.
See, I don't
like
know.
Like, Karl Malone is out there just making fertilizer.
I'd like to go to Utah, man. There's a lot of beautiful parks out there. I heard, what's their big city out there? Salt Lake City. I heard Salt Lake City's great. I don't know. I think Utah might be fun to visit. I think you're crapping on the Utah audience we have right now, Berlo.
Well, I think most Utah people will say it's fun to visit, but unless you're a Mormon, it's not a place to live.
Well, maybe that's what I'm going for. Maybe the one wife I have now, it's been a year, I'm trying to expand to two.
So your whole job in life after you get the child is to get the second wife,
right,
move to Utah, and make fertilizer.
Do you see anything wrong with the plan?
Valid point. Exactly. I know you well.
Come join us. you got to get out of Georgia anyway. They're a bunch of weirdos out down there opening everything up. It's careless down there, damn it.
The Georgia fertilizer scene is not as exquisite as Utah, I will admit
that. All right, well, we'll see you there.
All right, well, how about the Sirius Dog Patrol, Scott? You can do that. The Sirius Dog Patrol is probably the world's most difficult job. Imagine you and Buddy trying to monitor 60,000 square miles of ice-cold land with nothing but a dog sled team to transport you. That is what the Sirius Dog Patrol is responsible for. In Greenland, it's a valuable property to have since it's some of the largest oil reserves in the world. So to keep them... their claim over the barren wasteland, Denmark dispatches the Sirius Dog Patrol to protect the sovereignty. The patrol consists of 12 men from Denmark's Royal Navy who split up into six teams, and they sole responsibility for this area, which is three times the size of Denmark. So your whole life is to be in frozen weather with one other person patrolling Denmark to make sure nobody steals oil.
See, I kind of like the job. Like, if that was like a 9-to-5, that would be pretty cool. Like, I like the idea of like going home. Like, all right, and you're not completely alone. You're with a bunch of cool dogs. You know, keeping people from stealing, that's kind of fun. Like, so far out of these, I'm in on this one.
One other note I forgot to mention, the average temperature in Greenland is 14 degrees, with the lowest recorded temperature being 67 below zero.
So it's a little chilly. It's a little
nippy. Little, might bring like a little sweatshirt or something.
Yeah, bring a scarf or something.
All right. You could be a fire lookout at Gila National Forest.
Sounds fun.
Yeah, Gila National Forest is located in remote parts of New Mexico wilderness, which gets pretty balmy during the summer. This can make the area susceptible to forest fires, which are almost impossible to put out. So nipping it in the bud before it spreads is a high priority for the park's management. Fire lookouts are known as freaks of the peaks because most of often that not, they're completely alone for long periods of time on top of high lookout points, which is suitable only for certain types of people. Sole duty is to watch out for smoke atop a 45-foot tower using binoculars. If that sounds incredibly boring to you, you'd be absolutely right. Connor has had a huge amount of downtime, Connor being the person who has the job currently, which he fills with hiking and other outdoor activities, along with reading and writing. He also repairs his cabin every time he returns for the summer. He usually spends about 9 months on top of the tower checking out for any signs of forest fires.
Again, doesn't sound too terrible. I mean, it sounds like it's kind of interesting work, at least. Like, much more interesting than the fertilizer guy. I mean, the dog guy sounds kind of cool, other than the weather. But I would put this maybe second place.
Second place? So, like, if you had a Zoom call, and we'll call Steve the fertilizer person, you'd be ragging on him a bit where he has to drink a couple extra.
Right. Take a shot, bro. You know, like, how's the fertilizer going down there?
Well, that drink too stiff for you? Does it taste like your work?
Oh! Boom! Roasted.
Hmm. How about Ranger on Farn Island? The Farn Island are some of the most isolated and rough islands in the United Kingdom, if not the world. So its rangers have to equally tough as nails to live there. David Steele, who worked on the islands for over a decade, can testify to the brutal conditions there, since during its frequent storms, he was cut off from the rest of the world for an astonishing 17 days. After 4 days, he ran out of fruits and vegetables. By the next day, he ran out of milk, and days after that, bread. For the remainder of time, he was forced to ration out some tin supplies, as this kind of occurrence is not unusual at all. It wasn't until 2013 that conditions somewhat improved for the 11 wardens on the island, where they can actually grow some produce for the first time since 1909. The wardens spend 9 months out of the year on the island, away from all civilization. So why is it long-term? Well, probably never know. The rangers are responsible for Farn's biggest demographics, dolphins and seals. The island is home to one of the world's largest seal colonies and thousands of puffins. One of the rangers' duties is hair-drying damp chicks, since puffins use the island as breeding grounds.
I think this is cool.
This one I might be into.
I'm down for hair-drying puffins. Why not, man? Like, what I do is not much more different, like, better. Like, I don't feel more rewarded. Like, I'd rather keep a puffin dry.
You figure you have, like, relationships with these puffins. It's like, oh, you rank scallion, you get back here, you're all wet. And no, it's like, bah, 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 bah. I'm like, get wait, back wait, here, wait, wait.
Did you just hold on? Let's stop. Did you just name a puffin scallion?
No, that's like a nickname for, oh, you. Rampscallion, that's like an old school term for like a cheeky kind of person.
Is that like Buckaloo territory? Like back in the day?
That's old school kind of.
For a second, I thought you just named a puffin scallion. Like, get back here, scallion. Come here. Come here, Scallion, you little.
I could see a puffin named Rampscallion. I got to be honest with you. Like, the one that stays wet where you're always got to chase it with a blow dryer. Mm. I'm like, oh, you. It probably makes cute noises, and every time I get close, it'll, like, hide in a hole where, like, I'm not going anywhere until you come out and get your hair drying.
Do you see how, like, you know, you suppress these? You used to have these imaginary friends that were animals and things like that, like a platypus, and how just kind of...
Octopus.
Yeah, yeah. And how just one little, oh, yeah, Scallion the Puffet, all of a sudden you just have, like... amazing visions of how this would go down.
Well, in my head, it's beautiful. Like, I just see myself, I'm in an exotic land, I'm by myself, so I don't have to worry about toning down my burlu-ness, and I get to chase around birdies that look like penguins.
Chase down birdies. All right, Burlu, last one here.
How about researcher at the Concordia Research Station? The Concordia,
what am I researching, though?
Is located dead center in the middle of Antarctica. Hmm. This place is so hostile and desolate that there's just a 3-month window out of time of the year you can come home and go from this place. Yet it's there for future humanity lies. Concordia is so isolated that it's a perfect place to study the long-term effects of extended solitude. The researcher is available because it could help us prepare for manned missions to Mars. Concordia is a good place to do these kinds of projects because it's so similar to our neighboring red planet that is dubbed White Mars.
Eh. Not only does it seem lonely, it seems kind of boring. I don't know.
Yeah, but you can take credit. Like, I mean, we're going to be in Mars in 10 years, apparently. So, like... I figured there's a plaque going to be on the planet with your name on it.
I'd rather blow dry a puffin, and I'd take a lot more credit for that. Like, look at his hair. It's amazing, you know. Like, I discovered some red thing in the sky that no one cares about.
So you're not only going to dry the puffin, you're going to style the puffin.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Like a Brooklyn blowout, like a nice fade, maybe, or a man bun, you know, depends what I'm into that day, what the puffin tells me he wants.
Now, if we go back to that other story, they say there's hundreds of puffins on there. So will each one get a singular style, or are you just going to mix it up for each one?
I mean, you can only try for so long, right? Like, you know, and the hundreds of puffins guarantees my job. Like, I'm there for a while, because how many puffins can you possibly blow dry in one day?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, maybe we should get one of them people from the island on the cast, and I'll just find out. I mean,
that sounds great to me.
I mean, I gotta figure there's some technology where you can try them, like probably like his ancestors could only do like 5 puffins in a day, but now with the technology,
yeah,
it's like we get through 60 in an hour, baby.
He had an old, like, rinky-dink hair dryer where he had to, like, breathe in one side of it, and the puffin had to be strapped down.
Maybe if you recall a couple episodes back about our invention, maybe they used my snow...
Yes!
My snow-melting hair dryer to dry off the puffins. And maybe that's why we screwed up in that invention convention. Maybe we said, this is used to dry puffins, we could have won the thing.
I mean, yes, yes. Well, bro, that would be my choice of the jobs you have given me.
I got to be honest with you. I'm probably going to join you on that.
That's fine. In fact, finally, maybe it's not a secluded job. Maybe I could bring a buddy along and we can just dry. We could podcast at night and dry puffins by day. And it doesn't seem like a bad living.
Yeah. If Corona breaks out, I'll just go to the other lighthouse we probably live in. And it's like, all right, I'll do the puffins on this side of the island, Scott. You do that side, and we'll get back together to talk to a cheese lady.
Yeah, and then we can Skype from separate lighthouses, and then I'll pull a cord by mistake and lose an hour and a half interview. On that note, Burlo, it's time to go. Do you have anything to promote before we go?
As we keep up with supporting local businesses, I'm going to talk about Sumo Japanese Steak and Sushi.
Ooh.
Ate there last weekend. Wonderful thing. They're one of the few places that delivers sushi. They do hibachi. They do sushi. They do regular Japanese cuisine. Absolutely fabulous. Some of the rolls that they put out, like me and my wife, are pretty much guaranteed to go back there next Friday, or at least get it delivered to us. They're out of Villa Rica, so just give them a buzz. Their number is 678-840-8581. And like I said, it's just a $2 delivery to get some of the best sushi I've had down here. That's Sumo Japanese Steak and Sushi.
I will promote something very local to me, but they also keep our podcast on their platform, and they've been doing a lot of stuff to try to like entertain people from home in the area, and that is Denville Radio. Denville Radio is just they're trying to get it off the ground. DenvilleRadio.com. He's been doing like games and Wheel of Fortune and DJ LaFave. He tries to do a lot of interesting things, soccer stuff. He does our podcast. He puts things out there. So I think he deserves a little bit of love. So go check out Denville Radio. So that's it, guys. Life is funny. I want to thank, usually I'll say I want to thank Toby Philpott, and then life is funny. But life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Bye-bye.
Laters.
I'm deleting this.
Ain't all right. The hardness of my head. Now close your eyes, spin around, say, part time, you could find ain't the way that you want. But it's still alright.